This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Andy Robbins, sitting in for Gordon Evans. Very few U.S. presidents are thought of as literary, but two Western Michigan University professors have written a new book about one who was. Theodore Roosevelt, A Literary Life by Thomas Bailey and Catherine Joslin, charts his development as a writer, naturalist, explorer, historian, and politician. T.R.'s writing career started when he was just 9, filling journal after journal with acute observations of the world around him. By 1877, Roosevelt had published a slim booklet with a Harvard friend called Summer Birds of the Adirondacks. Catherine Joslin reads a passage.
Wearied by our unsuccess, we at last turned homeward, when suddenly the quiet was broken by the song of a hermit thrush. Louder and clearer it sang from the depths of the grim and rugged woods, until the sweet, sad music seemed to fill the very air and to conquer for the moment the gloom of the night. Then it died away and ceased as suddenly as it has come. Perhaps the song would have seemed less sweet in the daytime, but uttered as it was, with such surroundings, sounding so strange and so beautiful amid these grand but desolate wilds, I shall never forget it.
Roosevelt went on to write histories, books about hunting, books about his exploits in Cuba during the Spanish-American War, and countless articles and speeches, all before he became the youngest man ever to become president, at age 42 in 1901. Roosevelt could be pugnacious on the page. Thomas Bailey reads Roosevelt's description of a verbal altercation with the French ambassador in London during the funeral for King Edward VII in 1910.
He asks in French what color my coachman's coat had worn that evening, and I told him I did not know. He responded with much violence that the fact that both coachmen were dressed in black was an outrage, a slight upon the two great republics, as all the royalty's coachmen wore red coats, and that he would make a protest on behalf of us both. I told him to hold on, that he must not make any protest on my behalf, that I did not care what my coachman wore, and would be perfectly willing to see him wear a green coat with yellow splashes.
Bailey and Catherine Joslin say Theodore Roosevelt cut a wide swath through the literary scene in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but Joslin says his literary life is not as well known today.
He wrote 42 books. He wrote another 6 with other people. He wrote hundreds of essays and editorials, speeches. He wrote, he said, 150,000 letters. And so it became this big life that had gone largely unnoticed. When Henry Adams called him a man of action, we dismissed him as an intellectual man or a man of thought. And he was every bit as frenetic as a thinker and writer as he was as a politician. And so I turned to Tom Bailey, who knows environmental studies and
I've spent a lot of time over the course of the years reading nature writing and studying it and teaching it. And two of his good friends were John Muir and John Burroughs. And I was fascinated by the Brazil trip. And I was fascinated by the African hunting trip, which may be a little bit heavy going for the modern sensibility, but it's a very interesting book nonetheless. Roosevelt was a hero in my family. My grandmother gave me this cheap little book when I was about 9 years old called 50 Famous Americans. And of course, you know, right after George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, there came Theodore Roosevelt, right? So I've always just kind of been fascinated. And when Catherine said, you know, there's an awful lot of work here, I said, I'm more than happy to share it with you. And I think we ended up with her ears put in and my ears put in a total of 13 years getting this thing from the beginning through the publishing house of Upney today, right? So it's been a while.
Let's talk a little bit about Theodore Roosevelt's development as a writer and a man of letters. In your book, you say it starts very, very early. Like, I believe he's like 9 years old, and he's already writing journal after journal. Talk about that a little bit.
I started with the boy, and sometimes we'd come to the table when Tom was working with the old man, I was working with the boy, and I'd say, what a plucky little soul, what a delightful child, and Tom would go, what a cranky older man during the war years. So he started, as soon as he picked up a pencil, he started to write. But he was homeschooled. The kids were schooled by their aunt and then by an older sister. They read together. They read all kinds of things. They all wrote together. They learned to draw. That was part of the education of the children. They traveled together. They had a lot of experiences that were real and close in the world. And so he wanted to write these things down. There are early letters, even as early as 70s writing. He writes a different letter to his mother, and a different letter to his father, and a different one to his brothers and sisters. He wrote these intense journals where he even put down the names of the characters, who is who, like a play. But who was the journal for then? Was it for him, or was it for his family? That they would already know that, or maybe already he was writing for posterity, for us. And so I began to read his journals and his diaries and his letters in those early years. And he has the makings of he's a literary boy right from the start. He's nearsighted, remember, and until he's 14, nobody knows that. So he's a reader. Things happen close up for him. He's a reader and a writer from the start.
Much of his early interest seems to be dominated by the natural world and observing animals in particular, birds and smaller animals. And he seems to carry that forward throughout his entire life.
He does, indeed. And he sees his trip to Africa, the hunting trip to Africa, which we tend to think of as simply a safari, a pleasure safari to go, you know, collect some elephants and collect some lions. He saw that as a very important scientific exploration. And his duty, he was working for the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and he was bringing them specimens of birds, of large game animals, pretty much an example or two or three examples of every single one, which are still on display in the museum now on, is it 89th Street now? It's that wonderful, wonderful place. Those animals from Africa, almost all were collected, he would say, himself, I collected those animals for scientific purposes for the museum. A more skeptical contemporary viewer might think, well, I slaughtered those animals for contemporary viewing. Nonetheless, he saw that as a science and as observation. And he wrote intensely about those things. He was a good stylist when it came to describing animals, their behavior in the wild, what caused it, what resulted from it, et cetera, et cetera.
All writers, I suppose, are, you know, of their time, usually. And you mentioned that some of his, you know, hunting tales, which is another subgenre he was famous for, are perhaps a bit hard to take for people today because it's killing one animal after another.
There's sort of early experience with that. As I say, he was myopic, so he had to get close. He was really interested in the birds. He thought he'd be an ornithologist, but he had to kill the bird. He would watch the bird very closely, as close as he could get, and he'd make intricate notes about the bird, and then he'd kill the bird and get really close, and then he'd take measurements. And he was doing this as a kind of scientific task. There's another period later on. He has an early marriage, really adores his wife Alice, and they have a baby, and he's in the New York legislature, and he comes home a couple days afterwards in triumph to see the baby. And when he arrives at home, his brother is there to tell him that his mother is dying of typhus and his wife is dying of Bright's disease. And he goes into this house devastated by death close up. There it was. He'd been looking at death, but here it was. He held his mother. He held his wife. And after that, he left the baby Alice with his sister, and he went back to the Dakotas. He had a ranch in the Dakotas. And he spent the book that comes out of that is a hunting book that comes out in 1885, a year later. And it's about the killing of animals from lesser to greater, from near to far. And it's always looking into the face of death to try to figure out what had happened to him. And the word that he uses for the world, for the West and everything else, is the world is ephemeral, because to him it was ephemeral. You could have something and then not have it. Yeah. So and I think some of the hunting came from that closeness to death.
Right. And the death of his wife and his mother came very hard on the heels of the death, the completely unexpected death of his father, who died at 46 of stomach cancer, and it really devastated him. Right. And then to get the double devastation of his parents. He was always scholarly about his study of the natural world. He was a really good taxidermist, but then he was a really good writer, and he was a really good politician, and he was a really good historian. When he turned his mind to something, you know, he mastered it.
Now, you mentioned history and becoming an historian. His first published book is a history of the Naval War of 1812.
That's right.
I believe he was in his early 20s when it
That's
came
right.
out. And talk about that a little bit, because he did kind of consider himself to be an historian.
Oh, he didn't kind of consider himself. He meant to be a writer of note. That was his great goal. He was a writer before he was a politician. He was a writer after he was a politician. After he was president of the United States, he was president of the American Historical Association. And he delivered a thundering address to them, claiming that history was literature. And he was always, an historian and always a writer. And that first book, The Naval War of 1812, he'd been working on two pieces at that time. One was a creative hunting piece where he'd gone off with his brother Elliot and nearly died because a nor'easter came up and swept over their boat. And so, the other thing he was working on, he was going to law school too, and he was early married. But the other thing he was working on was this history, the Naval War of 1812. And he turned his mind to that. And one of the reasons he was fascinated by it is that his mother had come from the South, and her brothers, the Bullock brothers, had been heroes of the Confederacy, and they were sailors. And they were naval heroes. And, of course, they had to live in
Liverpool.
So he'd go to visit them, and he adored them. And they would tell him these stories about how the boats in the 19th century could fight on the waters. So when he came to tell the story of the Naval War of 1812, it's about the war really in the Great Lakes. And they wind up in Lake Champlain in the tiniest theater you can imagine, just blowing the guts out of everything. So he was able to tell that because it sort of came out of this family lore and family interest.
Theodore Roosevelt gets involved in politics fairly early as well. He's elected to the State Assembly in New York. He becomes a police commissioner in New York City. Later on becomes Assistant Secretary of the Navy, a job he shared later with one of his extended family members, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, also held that post some years later. And he becomes vice president and then becomes president on the assassination of William McKinley in 1901. And to this day is the youngest person to have become president of the United States at 42. How do you think getting involved in politics changed his writing?
Interesting question.
When he went to be the governor, he had just come back. He had been the assistant secretary of the Navy, and he had then gone to Cuba and had been involved in the dust up there. And he wanted to write a military memoir, a kind of history that put him as the main character. He loved writing it.
That would be the Rough Riders,
the one we all know.
Which one Witt later said should have been named Alone in Cuba.
That's what Finley Peter Dunne's character, Mr. Dooley, said. Yeah, if he'd done it all by himself, he might as well called it Alone in Cuba. So when he gets to the office of the governorship, he writes to his publisher who wants the book manuscript. And he says, you know, you just became governor. And he said, well, don't worry. Once I get this office in the groove, I'll send you the book. And what's that mean, in the groove? He wrote three books in the 2 years he was governor. And he did it largely because he started to dictate his thoughts, and he'd come with notes. Tom, you could talk about that, right?
Right. And he had an amanuensis, a secretary, who could really go fast, and he would just simply come in with his notes, and he would put them down on the desk, and he would begin to talk, and he would talk in complete paragraphs, and then in complete chapters, and then he had it all laid out in his mind. He never missed a beat. He knew precisely what he was going to say. He was so adept with language that it was like he had written it down so that it didn't sound like a first draft when it came out of his mind. But it speeded him up a lot. Then when he became president, he simply refused to write anymore. He was extremely scrupulous about the emoluments phrase in the Constitution. He did not want to be seen as profiting from his office. He didn't mind profiting after he had been the president and been successful, and he did. His early books that he wrote, well, his midlife books that he wrote shortly after he finished being president, made him a wealthy man. When he was a politician, he was a politician, and when he was a writer, he was a writer. That's how he saw it. So in fact, being president interrupted his writing life, but he picked it right up where he had left off when it was over with.
Quite early on, you mentioned this in the book, his writing style, he very seldom made major revisions to what he wrote. Lot of writers will agonize, and have constant, redrafts of their stuff. That was not Theodore Roosevelt.
No, and it was like the language got built in his mind even before it got to the pen. You're right to say that. Sometimes he'd change a verb or he'd get the sentence moving a little faster. But mostly when he went back over his writing, he thought, this would be even better if I wrote more.
More.
And so he'd write these little balloons with these delicate little letters that I don't know how anybody could pick out and figure out exactly
his
what
writing
he was doing.
Style, like his French, was agglutinative, right? I mean, it got bigger and bigger.
It got bigger
right?
and bigger.
He almost never cut things out. Right? I mean, he didn't see much sense in that, because if he thought it was right, and he'd put it down and maybe polish it a little.
He was a writer. Maybe we're unused to this today, or we write a lot. We write on the computer a lot, I suppose. But he wrote every day about what he did, about his activities, about his interests, about what he gained from observation. He told these wonderful stories of what he had seen in the woods and such. And so language was very near in his mind, always very accessible. I guess that's what I'd say.
Another thing that you talk about in the book is his concept of, action into words, words into action.
Uh-huh. When he started out, he got so that he used a phrase like that. I don't see any reason for words that don't come out in action. And maybe that's what really ties the writing together with the political life. I think you've probably gotten that right. That is to say, if you had things that happened in the world and you turned them into words, you could turn those words then into deeds. And so he did that with his hunting and hunting trips and what you could learn from it scientifically, I suppose. But he also learned that there was such a thing as political language. And political language was law. So you could take an idea, say, from a novel like The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's book. He hoped to tell the world about the plight of the Lithuanian immigrants working in the meatpacking places in Chicago, but everybody got worried about the pigs and whether the meat was clean and such. And so he could turn that into the Pure Food and Drug Act. And so actions could become words in a novel. He could read the novel. Then that could be put into legal language, and that could change the world. So in that way, action and language came together for him.
Later in life, after he finishes with the presidency, although he tries to get back, because he doesn't like what Howard Taft has done as the Republican who succeeded him. And runs on the Progressive or Bull Moose Party ticket, doesn't win. Woodrow Wilson becomes president. He goes on this expedition first he goes to Africa, as you mentioned, and then later on he goes on this expedition to South America that almost kills him. he was in his 50s at that point, I guess mid-50s. And do you think he was trying to prove to himself that he was still that man of action?
I think he probably was. And I think maybe a whole bunch of his friends thought that he was making a foolish choice in going down that river. But yes, he viewed it always as his last chance to be a boy. He viewed it as a possibility of putting his stamp on exploration that he had never done before. And in fact, he did. He and Colonel Ronton discovered a river that was 1,000 miles long and, you know, carried as much water as the Columbia River. And nobody knew it had existed. And in fact, Roosevelt and Ronton put it on the map, right? He also, whenever an opportunity came along to do something, he took his own motto, the man in the arena, seriously. If something difficult was going down, he wanted to be the guy to do it. And so he accepted, if his son Kermit hadn't been with him, he probably would have died on that trip. It was really a rugged trip. His book, not the books about the trip, like the book by Candace Millard, The River of Doubt, or Joseph Ornig's book, My Last Chance to Be a Boy, they tell the story. Roosevelt's book travels through the Brazilian wilderness. That book is of an entirely different nature. You don't sense the struggle. You don't sense the danger. He only admits that he was really in perilous danger when the danger has already passed. His focus in that book is on the exploration, on the river, on the adventure, the rapids, and the working with the men. It's quite a disciplined and in some ways very brave book, which leaves out what Candace Millard and Joseph Ornig think is the best part.
You know, as we're wrapping up here, I wanted to ask you both what your thoughts were about what is Theodore Roosevelt's literary legacy. He did old attitudes that, towards the end of his life in this progressive era, he would say things that, you know, could come out of the mouth of Bernie Sanders. In terms of capitalism and how that should be regulated. On the other hand, he had attitudes towards minorities and particularly Native Americans that are racist. So what do you think is his ongoing legacy as a writer and a man of letters?
I think we read people in their time if we can. We take their measure, as I think that's fair for any writer. There were extraordinary things that he did toward the African American community. He invited Booker T. Washington to the White House when even Twain thought it was a bad idea. So in some ways, he was forward thinking. He got into this this whole idea of race suicide. Wanted white women to have five babies, and anybody listening to him at the time, the women in the audience, would roll their eyes. So those things are locked in time. But you're quite right to say that you can go back and read that progressive platform, and it's very much like the one Bernie Sanders carries around. And so I'd say that about his legacy. I'd also say that we really could go back and give him a chance to look at these books that would tell us a lot about our own growth in history. And at points, they're lovely to read, so that I think that he is remarkable as a writer. And I can't think of another character as complex as he is as a writer. I just can't.
Did he write the masterpiece he was hoping to write? Maybe not. Are his books worth reading? I think very much so. What I'd say, I'd echo what Catherine was saying and enlarge upon it a little bit. We are creatures of our own time, and when we read the vast Roosevelt's work, which has this vast self-assurance, I mean, I don't think he ever once in his whole life thought he might be wrong. I really don't. But when we measure that against what those books really mean now, I think it's a lesson for all of us in humility and in wondering what it is that we're so self-assured about, that we're wrong about, because he was a brilliant, successful, extraordinarily accomplished man and writer, and deeply flawed, and time has proven him maybe to be more flawed than he ever dreamed that he would be. It's important to try to assess that brilliant man as richly and in as fully and most human terms as you can, and not dismiss him.
I just want to make a comment about reading our book. Now, because we're doing Roosevelt, his material is all available online, so that you can, in the midst of reading what we might decide one thing or another about a book, you can just reach the book. It's easily accessible to you, and you can read along with us. And I think that that's an amazingly different thing about reading about a literary person, especially a person like Roosevelt.
This is not covered in the book, but as I was reading the book, I was reminded of someone who came along a generation later and not in this country, Winston Churchill, who was a politician, was a writer, was a historian, and was a man of action. Do you think that there's a comparison to be made there?
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
I think there's a book in there.
Yeah. I think, well, they weren't of a different generation. They were exactly the same generation. It's just that Winston Churchill lived forever, and I think he may have been 4 or 5 years younger than Theodore, but that's all. There's a wonderful passage in the letters of Winston Churchill coming to Sagamore Hill to have supper with Edith and Theodore, and boy, oh boy, did they not like him. She especially didn't like him. He drank too much. He slouched. He used bad language, and Theodore, of course, was frightfully jealous because he was a big game hunter and a very successful one, and he had been so far a successful politician. They were implicit rivals, and it may very well be, although Roosevelt wrote everything himself, and Churchill had huge coterie of young men to write this stuff for him, which he then polished, right? It may very well be that Roosevelt's a better writer. I wouldn't make that claim because I haven't read him near as carefully as I've read. I wouldn't make that claim except as a kind of guess.
Right. But I think you're right to match them up.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of they were prolific writers and men of the world. You could write that book.
the thing that when you get to the part of the book in Roosevelt's life where he's just desperate to get to Cuba, to get involved in the Spanish-American War, and ultimately helps lead the so-called Rough Riders up San Juan Hill and all of that. Churchill also had a genius for inserting himself into relatively small wars, but to cover himself in glory afterwards and then write about it.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, they were both building political careers. They really were, right? And doing it very skillfully, by the way.
Theodore Roosevelt's long history was the winning of the West, and I would argue that it stops at Kettle Hill when he can be the hero of the story. There was really nothing more to say about westward expansion.
Catherine Jocelyn and Thomas Bailey are professors of English at Western Michigan University. They'll talk about their new book, Theodore Roosevelt, A Literary Life, at BookBug in Kalamazoo on Thursday. There's more information about the event on our webpage. This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Andy Robbins. Thanks for listening.